Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Thanks very much for downloading this double edition of the documentary from Singapore. So I've done a lot of narcotics-related journalism, especially in Latin America and the US. But last year, Singapore attracted a lot of attention because it retains the death penalty for drug trafficking offences, including the trafficking of cannabis. It's an important story, but when I dug a bit deeper, I was surprised to learn that Singapore also has an extensive system of compulsory drug rehabilitation. And that's for anyone caught using illicit narcotics, even casual users. I thought that'd be interesting to explore, so that's the first part of what you're about to hear. The second half looks much more at Singapore's commitment to the use of the death penalty in drug trafficking cases. This is the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Linda Presley with assignment. Singapore. Drugs, rehab, execution. Meet Kim.
Many young Singaporeans will have used cannabis at least once or twice, but I was in a small group of regular cannabis users.
She's a young professional. These are her words, but it's not her voice, and Kim's not her real name. She began smoking marijuana when family life became messy and upsetting. Things got better, but the habit stuck.
My social circle grew to become primarily cannabis users. They became my primary circle of friends.
If Kim was North American or European, you wouldn't be listening to her story. But Singapore has some of the harshest drug laws. Using any illicit narcotic, including cannabis, is illegal. And if you're convicted of trafficking drugs like heroin, methamphetamine and cannabis in larger quantities, you may face the ultimate punishment, death by hanging. Kim had a reliable supplier of quality marijuana, and her friends asked if she'd get some for them.
That's what I did. I never marked up the prices because this was a friendship. I'm helping you to purchase something we both use anyway.
So you're kind of like a middlewoman. You get it from your supplier, you give it to your friend, they give you the money, you give it to the supplier. Is that how it worked?
Essentially, yes.
In Singapore, if you sell, give, deliver, administer, transport or distribute narcotics, that's drug trafficking. Kim's life began to unravel when one of her friends was caught by the Central Narcotics Bureau.
During his interrogation, he gave my name as the person who supplied him with cannabis. They apprehended me, and then they were digging through my phone, my messages, and the other person was picked up too.
When you were told what the charges against you were, I mean, how did you react?
I was wrecked with horror. I've heard of friends of friends getting caught for consumption, but to have charges of drug trafficking levelled at me? That was just overwhelming. Complete and utter fear of what is going to pan out for me.
So you haven't yet been sentenced, but what are the best and worst case scenarios for you now?
The minimum sentence would be 5 years in prison. There are no cuts, no discounts. That's the best case scenario. The worst case can be up to 20 years.
If she was male, Kim would be facing strokes of the cane too. Let me put some of this in context for you. Singapore's an outlier when it comes to drug policy. In jurisdictions around the world, cannabis for recreational use is decriminalised. In the US, 24 states have legalised it. And it's worth noting that in Minnesota, where Tim Walz, Kamala Harris's running mate, is governor, it's permitted for citizens to have around 900 grams of marijuana. In Singapore, if you have 500 grams or more, the death penalty becomes mandatory. In next week's assignment, I'll be exploring the application of capital punishment in drug cases in Singapore. But this week, my focus is the island's drug users. The friends Kim sourced cannabis for admitted consuming illicit narcotics, not nearly as serious as trafficking. So what happened to them? Well, they weren't prosecuted.
They were just sent to the drug rehabilitation centre. They got 6 months.
When they're caught, drug users are evaluated as low, moderate or high risk. The authorities don't disclose how that assessment's made, but those deemed moderate or high risk find themselves in Singapore's state-run Drug Rehabilitation Centre, or DRC, located in a huge complex in the east of the island. There's no private residential drug rehab facility in Singapore, so no swanning around in fluffy bathrobes with accommodation provided in cosy ensuite bedrooms. When drug users are picked up, as Kim's friends were, they may spend months here.
I'm Ravin Singh. I'm the second superintendent of Institution S1, which is primarily for first and second time drug abusers. There are about 500 or so of them.
Superintendent Singh of Singapore's prison service shows us around. He takes us into an unoccupied cell that usually accommodates 7 or 8 men. At the back, there are 2 squat toilets and a shower behind a waist-high wall. There are mounted cameras in the ceiling, and on the bare concrete floor, there are painted yellow markings used to facilitate a roll call of inmates 3 times a day.
They're expected to sit in this box, this yellow box over here. That's where the CCTV will be able to capture their images.
There are no beds.
There are no beds in any of our prisons, only in our medical wards.
But this is drug rehabilitation. It's not prison.
Yes. So whilst it is rehabilitation, it is still a very deterrent regime. So while we rehabilitate you, we also want you to remember that it's not offence that you should repeat. We don't want to make the stay too comfortable.
So everybody sleeps on the floor, on a mat?
On a mat, yes.
That's quite harsh, no? You've been caught taking drugs the first time, and you come into... And this is effectively a prison, right?
Well, it looks like a prison, but like I said, you'll see that the inmates are a bit more free-roaming. Their movements are not so tightly controlled.
And nor will a stay at the DRC get you a criminal record, a recognition that drug users aren't simply bad people. They often need rehabilitation. But like regular prisoners, they're allowed only 2 visits a month. In the cell, carefully laid out on the floor to show visitors like us, are the items every inmate gets on arrival, including a thin rush mat to sleep on.
So they get T-shirts, shorts, so that's their blanket. And then you'll see that a lot of the items are transparent, so that's for us to, you know, to enhance our security so they cannot hide any contraband within those things.
So there's toothbrush and toothpaste, and a bar of soap, some flip-flops.
You'll see the toothpaste is also transparent, and the toothbrush is made of rubber.
So nobody can harm themselves with that?
You can't make it into a shank and cause harm. Yeah.
So you can't turn it into a knife. Right. And these are the only belongings that they have while they're here?
On top of these, they will have books they can borrow from the library or their families can send in, together with their course materials that they can bring in. And all inmates also get access to an electronic tablet, and they use this electronic tablet to send out letters. They can play games, and they can read course materials on it as well. Yeah. So they are given 90 minutes access to it each day.
90 minutes?
Yes.
At the DRC, inmates spend up to 6 hours a day in a classroom on psychology-based courses.
My name is Lau Kuan Li. I'm a Deputy Director for Correctional Rehabilitation Services. So the aim is to motivate inmates to want to change. In this case, is to want to stay away from drugs, to renew their lives without drugs, and to address the negative attitudes, negative thinking regarding drug use.
Okay, should we go in?
Yes.
We're doing the exercise. I try to focus on my tapping, but...
Inside the bright, spacious room, there's a mindfulness session in progress. Around 15 men sit in a horseshoe around a course leader.
What is important here is being mindful of your present moment. What are you?
The prison authorities have selected 2 inmates to speak to us. They're not cannabis smokers. They both have a history of methamphetamine use. Meth is a powerful, synthetic, highly addictive stimulant, and the most commonly abused drug in Singapore. And for a young man I'll call Jack, reeling from a romantic breakup earlier this year, his drug use became more than a little problematic.
I was in public. I hadn't eaten or slept in 4 days. I was basically having a psychosis episode, and the police were informed. What happened for about 4 to 5 hours before the arrest is still a blur to me.
Oh, you just don't remember?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, methamphetamine is a devious, pernicious drug. Yeah. Right? That happens to a lot of people.
Correct.
They can get psychosis.
That's right. During my time of use, I never thought it would ever happen to me.
This is Jack's second time in the DRC. He was here before in 2021.
The first time was, I'm never coming back to this hellhole. You know, my first time, it was 6 months in, 6 months out.
That's half a year incarcerated in the DRC and half a year being monitored in the community. But then Jack relapsed. This time as a repeat drug offender. He's going to be resident here for 8 months and then tracked outside for a further 10.
So in hindsight, when I think about my first sentence, I felt that I never actually did the work. This time, I felt like, because of the circumstance of how I was caught this time around, I felt that it was a big eye-opener.
Scary, right?
Scary. Very scary. The programs that they offer here really is like cognitive behavioral therapy stuff. So, disputing negative thoughts. Now being here, I practice these tools like, is it true that, you know, although I have friends that have left me and friends have that have given up on me, is it true that I will never find new friends?
No, it's not.
Yeah. Just continuously disputing or challenging these negative thoughts is something new that I've started practicing doing. Coming back here, although being away from family, being away from friends is painful, right? Coming back here, I really needed to understand, to learn, to live a better life. So I cannot say that I will not come back, but I will do whatever it takes to stay on this journey of sobriety.
And Singapore commits huge resources to enabling people like Jack to stay clean once they leave the drug rehab centre. Towards the end of his stay here, he'll be helped to prepare for his return to the community, to secure work. There'll be counselling sessions with his family. He might be connected with a volunteer who'll support him when he's back home. And there's a handful of drop-in centres to help him stay on track. Like WeCare, a non-profit that's also commissioned by the government to provide services for former inmates of the DRC.
This is the art room.
Oh, show me the art. Yeah. Oh.
So art is a popular activity here. It rehabilitates. It's great because you can express yourself through art that you normally wouldn't be able to through words.
Leslie Goh is WeCare's communications manager and shows me around the airy, welcoming space. And he detects the beginnings of a shift in attitude among both the general population in Singapore and the authorities towards those hooked on highs.
I think in the last few years especially, our Ministry of Law has realised that putting people behind bars is not the best way to treat drug addiction.
Because the community support now in Singapore, from what I gather, is quite extensive, isn't it?
Yes, it's getting stronger. Because we do recognise that this very vulnerable community needs help from the whole community, not just us. Yeah, it takes a whole village, so to speak, to get the person back on their feet again.
But do you need the stick as well as the carrot? Because the laws are harsh, aren't they?
I won't comment on the politics of it. We are in the helping industry, so we only deal with carrots.
And once drug users leave the hyper-controlled environment of the government drug rehab centre, they need those carrots. Because temptation lies in wait, sometimes when you least expect it.
Just before Chinese New Year, I was actually doing some spring cleaning at home. I was clearing a pile of old clothing, and there was a pack of stuff dropped off in front of me.
Oh, it was drugs you'd forgotten about?
Yeah.
In the clothes?
Yes, in the stack of clothing. My heart was, like, pumping very fast. My hands were shaking.
I'll call this man Vincent.
I grabbed the keys. I went out of the house. I walked for about 20 to 30 minutes. I take deep breath. And that are the things that I learned here, like mindfulness. So after that, I asked myself, are you ready to go back home? So I went back. Immediately I took the packet and I flushed it down the toilet bowl. Then after that, I called my friends. We had a group chat.
The moment passed. Vincent resisted. Now a volunteer at WeCare and nearly 3 years clean, he used to hold down a professional job whilst using methamphetamine and ecstasy. Vincent had tried and failed to end his dependency. So, he says, his arrest came at the right time for him because he wanted to stop. But his stay in the DRC led to a painful deception.
My family is a very traditional Chinese family. My mom didn't know what happened to me. Up to this point, she didn't know. Only my sister knows about it.
So your mum doesn't know that you went into the drug rehabilitation centre?
She didn't. Because she's very old. I don't know. I just don't want to disappoint her.
And where did your mum think you were those 3 months that you were missing completely?
So I told her I was working overseas.
For 9 months after he left the drug rehabilitation centre, Vincent was monitored using an electronic tag. Surveillance remains a critical part of Singapore's mission to keep its drug-using population clean.
And the officer is getting out a rather large pair of scissors.
Okay.
The ankle tag attached to a short man in his 50s, his hair clipped neatly into a crew cut, is snipped off.
Hello, how does that feel?
He's
very happy.
And how long have you been on the tag?
26 months.
But I imagine that you're a repeat drug offender, are you?
He has been in and out of the DRC for 6 times.
What was the drug you've been struggling with?
Heroin.
Heroin, okay. Because you look very healthy.
Okay, thank you.
Well, listen, good luck.
Thank you.
That was the prison service's Karen Lee translating. She's director for the Community Corrections Command, supervising drug users once they're released.
I think it's amazing for him to stay drug-free for 26 months.
He's looking good, right?
He is. He is healthy. And that's what we hope that all of our supervisees can be. And they live a fruitful life and they have reintegrated into society successfully. Yeah, because while 3 out of 10 do come back as repeat drug abusers, we should not forget that there are 7 others out there who are successfully living their lives as reintegrated citizens of Singapore. Would you like to see the urine supervision?
Very much.
Cubicle.
Urine testing is another way to encourage offenders to stay away from narcotics. Around 3,000 Singaporeans presently have their urine analysed regularly for drugs like heroin, meth, cannabis and ecstasy. And in this centre close to the DRC, it's a bit like going through airport security. Supervisees, as they're called, go through a scanner to make sure they're not carrying any other liquid or someone else's urine in an attempt to trick the system. There are cubicles. After they enter, the doors lock behind them. Everything's automated.
The technology that you see here is actually the first of its kind in the world.
So from the moment somebody pees into the urinal until getting the test result, how long does that take?
It takes an average of 5 to 7 minutes.
And during that time, the person who's urinated stays in the cubicle?
Yes, but what we have also prepared videos for him to watch. Mr. Bean, for example. So it's not so boring. Okay. But that is necessary so that once the test results are out, if it is negative, the door, you will see it turns green, the door automatically opens, and the supervisee is free to go.
And if the light is red?
So if the test results are positive, the light is red, the door will remain closed. There will be an alert sent to our control centre, and our staff will then come and respond.
Will that person be allowed to go home if the test is positive?
No.
They'll be held, and their urine tested again the next day. If it's still positive for drugs, they're looking at more time locked up. Singapore's a clean, ordered nation state. You don't see obvious drug users on the streets or crashed out in any of its beautifully kept parks. And anyone will tell you they feel safe to walk around in the dead of night. In a tropical climate when the heat's intense, Singaporeans live life in glitzy, cavernous shopping malls. Downtown, adjacent to one of these, is yet another skyscraping tower of offices.
11th floor.
And this is home to Promises, a private clinic offering outpatient therapy and treatment founded by Dr. Muni Winslow, an eminent addiction psychiatrist who worked for decades in government institutions. Singapore celebrates 60 years of independence next year, and I'm interested in hearing about the genesis of its hardline drug policy.
One of the things that happened in the early years of nationhood was that I think the government had to figure out what to do because there were slums, there were secret societies, and they used a lot and they controlled the drug trade. And at that time, I think the first cabinet chaired by Lee Kuan Yew basically made a decision that this was not a public health issue, but this was a public order issue. And so then, early 1970s, I think, the Misuse of Drugs Act came into effect. And that basically criminalized drug addiction and drug trafficking.
There were changes again in the 90s, I think.
Yes, in the 1990s, unfortunately, the world was going through a phase of war on drugs, and there were a bunch of clinical corrections psychologists from California and Texas who came over to advise. And they basically had a three-strike ruling where they would tell you that it's a waste of time to treat people with addictions, give them two chances at recovery, and then throw the book at them and lock them up.
In prison?
For long periods.
So the idea then was that there's no point and don't even waste your resources on treating people.
They had thrown a lot of resources at it. They had a revolving door. People were coming in, doing drug rehabilitation, rotating out, and lo and behold, within a very short period of time, they would relapse and come back into the same system and then be incarcerated again, and then they would do it ad nauseam.
But the problem with relapse, I mean, the government's worried about that. That's still an issue in 2024, isn't it?
It is. We're still worried about it, but the numbers are improving as far as I can tell. In the past, you would see three quarters of your cohort or more. Three quarters would get caught. The other quarter probably was smarter.
So that would have been a 75% relapse rate. Karen Lee from the prison service told us that nowadays, 3 in 10 drug users will return as repeat offenders, a significant drop. And local studies in Singapore show that overall drug use is low. This was verified by the United Nations Office on Drugs and Crime, although the agency told me it wasn't feasible for them to conduct their own survey about the consumption of illegal substances in Singapore because of the existence of the death penalty. I'm interested in what I've seen and heard at the DRC and asked Dr. Winslow about the impact of compulsory rehabilitation on drug users in Singapore.
One of the good things that we've discovered, if you look at evidence-based policies in drug and addiction, is that it does not really matter whether the treatment offered is voluntary or non-voluntary.
Really?
Yes.
I thought the mantra was that you only manage to stop taking drugs if you really want to.
Yes, but when you're in a place where you can learn and you can understand what you've been doing to yourself, what you've been doing to others, then it gives you an opportunity to actually reflect on what's going on. And you must understand, once a person has addiction, there's very little reflection going on. It is just, where do I get my next hit? Where do I get my next use? Whereas when you take a time out, you're given that time to reflect, and what am I doing with my life? What is this the way that I want to live?
But the way that it works now in Singapore, when people have to go into the drug rehabilitation centre, they get the treatment they need, do they?
Much better now, because the whole system, or even the criminal justice system, has got a load of psychologists and counsellors who are actually trained in addictions.
Over 3 decades, Dr. Winslow has seen profound changes to drug treatment in Singapore. However, there's much that might be judged draconian. For example, if a patient discloses use of narcotics to their GP, it's a legal requirement for doctors to report that information to the authorities. This may well deter people from getting help with out-of-control drug use. In many ways, it's a one-size-fits-all approach to narcotics in Singapore, something I put to the Minister for Home Affairs and Law when we meet, Kay Shanmugam.
Millions of people around the world use recreational drugs and they don't get addicted. But here in Singapore, incarceration for even maybe casual users means that thousands of lives are interrupted. Education, work, family. I mean, do the benefits of zero tolerance really outweigh the harms?
First of all, the suggestion that millions of people use drugs around the world without suffering is just untrue. Once you're addicted, you need to feed your addiction. Often what happens, you need to go and get the money for it How do you get the money? You often commit crimes. Now, I mean, I don't have the precise numbers, but I think that half of all burglaries and robberies and other similar crimes in England and Wales are committed by addicts, drug addicts. I think probably half of homicides too are by drug dealers and drug abusers.
The minister's right about this. According to UK government data, 52% of all murders in England and Wales were drug-related in the year ending March 2022.
Take Netherlands, take Belgium. Young children of 13 years old, 14 years old are being recruited as drug couriers. 100,000 Americans died between September of 2022 and September of 2023.
You're talking about fentanyl, yeah.
100,000. That's more than the wars in Iraq, Afghanistan and Vietnam.
More than 100,000 accidental overdoses in the US. That is more Americans than died in those three conflicts. It's worrying global statistics like these that convince the minister and probably most Singaporeans that the nation's drug policies are the right ones and that the death penalty for drug trafficking must stay on the books.
After my arrest, I spent the first maybe 1 month just being completely paralysed.
Remember Kim? She's not facing the gallows, but she is waiting to hear about her prison sentence following charges of trafficking cannabis to her friends.
I decided to put my energy into work, to try to excel on some level, make the best of whatever time I have left. Now I've gotten a date where there could be a possible sentencing, which means I might have to say farewell to the rest of my family and friends before the end of the year.
And have you told people at work about this?
They've been supportive. They acknowledge it is a mistake and that I would never do it again.
Can I ask you what you knew about drug law in Singapore? Were you aware that the penalties were so severe?
No, I wasn't aware the penalties would be minimally 5 years. The cases of trafficking we read about in the news are like across the border or large quantities. I just never realised that those same charges could be used against someone who did what I did.
Is there somewhere in you that you've come to terms with the fact that you're going to be serving a prison sentence?
Actually, once I heard that there was very little possibility of me not serving a sentence, I took some time to mourn almost for the period of time of my life that I would lose, and also to plan ahead. I think I've accepted prison on a deeper level. It just never gets easier as the day draws nearer.
You're listening to the documentary from the BBC World Service. Coming up, paying the ultimate price for trafficking narcotics.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Linda Presley with Assignment. Singapore, drugs, rehab, execution.
We're just about to see a more widespread execution of through crime.
Nearly 30 million passengers landed at Changi Airport last year. And this vast transport hub is one of Singapore's front lines in its war on narcotics.
So you've got two officers here waiting and they're looking at some of the passengers who are coming through here now. They've chosen one middle-aged man, his 40s or 50s, and his luggage is now going to be checked.
The passenger suitcase is put through the X-ray machine by immigration and checkpoint officers. Inspector Shannon Sim oversees the process as the palms of the man's hands are swabbed.
And then after that, we'll put through this ion scan machine. And from there, if there is a positive detection, the machine will prompt us that there is a detection. And then they will show us like what drug it is.
What, just from the palms of your hands?
The palms of your hands are the most common places. Yeah.
Around the globe, trafficking narcotics is a serious offence, attracting lengthy prison terms. But in Singapore, you could be looking at a death sentence. As a nation that's recently executed those convicted of drug-related crime, Singapore keeps company with Iran, China, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, and probably Vietnam and North Korea too. If Inspector Shannon Sim has a positive result, the Central Narcotics Bureau takes over.
I'm Superintendent Muhammad Rizal. I'm the commanding officer of the Checkpoints Command for Central Narcotics Bureau. So I'm in charge of the operations of all narcotics officers who are based in all the checkpoints, for example, the land checkpoints, the sea checkpoints, as well as the air checkpoints.
Any suspicious items in luggage are checked using chemical tests or a laser.
So it takes a wide range of drugs, the common ones that we see as well, like heroin, ice, cannabis, methamphetamines.
But in Singapore, it's not only trafficking that's punished. It's illegal for any citizen or permanent resident to consume drugs, either in Singapore or overseas. And for those who arrive at Changi and are suspected of, for example, having smoked marijuana, there's a handy saliva test.
Yeah, so once we open it up, we'll swab the cheeks or the tongue. The suspect can choose to do it himself, or we'll do it for him if he needs assistance. And then we'll run the test, and then it'll tell us whether it's positive or negative.
How long does that take?
It takes about 10 minutes.
If you're Singaporean and an illegal substance is found in your system, it may mean you spend the next few months in compulsory rehab, in prison-like conditions, 7 or 8 to a cell. But regardless of nationality, all passengers are treated alike on arrival at Changi.
Anyone caught with drugs in Singapore, the actions are the same. It's really a warning all the way up to imprisonment. But foreigners generally don't go through rehabilitation in Singapore.
But here at the airport, would they be deported or what would happen to them?
That's a possible course of action. Yes, it is. Deportation, yes.
I mean, some people listening to you might think it's a bit draconian. Okay, you have your drug laws in Singapore, but to impose those on people coming from outside when they haven't taken drugs in the territory?
It's part of our zero tolerance on drugs. So it doesn't really matter who you are. As long as we suspect that you have taken drugs, it's not something that we want within our borders.
Zero tolerance. It's a term you hear a lot in Singapore.
Primary school, my best friend was a Malay. When I was a teen, my best friend was an Indian. My mom is Chinese and I have French heritage. Where else in this world can you find such unity in diversity? Only in Singapore.
Proud Singaporean Bruce Matthews shows us his social media feed. A larger-than-life ex-convict and former drug addict, Bruce is a motivational speaker and gives talks to community groups and schools about how he escaped the grip of heroin and methamphetamine.
I've made it my life's mission after prison to tell my story. Although I've stayed clean for many years, I know that the addiction has not left me yet. The very minute I let my guards down would be the start of my downfall. So each time when I go out to share my story, not only does it encourage others, it is also a reminder to myself not to go back to drugs.
Bruce is a passionate defender of Singapore's hard line on drugs, including its commitment to retaining the death penalty for trafficking.
It is these rules, regulations and law that allows our country to remain safe. Singapore has a zero tolerance drug policy. And it is with this law that Singapore is what it is today. You know, my daughter could go out at 3 a.m. in the morning and I wouldn't feel fearful that she might get hurt. So, like what I always tell everyone, you don't like these laws, ship out. Just imagine, when we gained independence, what did Singapore have? Absolutely nothing. We don't have natural resources. We don't even have water. All we had were the people. Singapore is very dependent on foreign dollars, foreign investors. Would anyone in their right mind invest in a country that's filled with drug addicts, gangsters, and big drug problem? Absolutely no one in the right mind would do it. The government did what they had to do to ensure that Singapore prosper. And in 50 years, we became a first world country. We became a financial superpower. It is through all this strict governance and strict laws.
But so explain to me, how did the existence of the death penalty, how did that deter you? Because you were still a drug user, right?
I'm addicted to drugs, yes. I love getting high. But it was exactly due to this death penalty thing that I had never even thought about trafficking drugs. I was very fearful. But you think about this, Linda. Drugs is still coming in on a regular basis. I dread to think what would happen if these laws aren't in place.
In Singapore, a death sentence becomes mandatory in cases where the quantity of drugs cited in a trafficking case crosses certain weight thresholds. Those amounts are 15 grams of heroin, 30 grams of cocaine, 250 grams of methamphetamine, 500 grams of cannabis. Since March 2022, when executions resumed after COVID, 20 people have been hanged in Singapore, all but one of them executed for drug trafficking offences. Calls for Singapore to reconsider its use of capital punishment and impose prison sentences instead have been rejected, especially by the Minister for Home Affairs and Law, K. Shanmugam.
If you can convince me, or anyone can convince me, or us, because it's a government policy, that removing death penalties saves more lives, we will do it tomorrow. The real issue is what is in the interest of Singaporeans and does it save more lives than it takes away? And we have absolutely clear evidence that many, many more lives are saved by reason of having the death penalty in the books.
So you're talking about a deterrent effect?
A huge deterrent effect, as a result of which the amount of drugs being trafficked into Singapore is substantially reduced. People don't want to traffic drugs into Singapore, mostly. And if they do, they traffic below the amounts that attract the death penalty. So that reduces supply.
I'm not sure that the deterrence argument is proven from what I've read about deterrence studies. I mean, the only studies I've seen that have been done about homicide in the United States. And they've found that actually when you take away the death penalty, the number of homicides hasn't increased.
Let me explain the deterrence effect. In 2021, we've done a study in the region from where many of our drug traffickers come. I think it's about 83% in the region say that the capital punishment is much more of a deterrent compared with life imprisonment in the context of drug trafficking.
But that's a perception, though, isn't it, in those regions?
That's very important.
But when you're talking about the theory of deterrence, it depends on rational decision-making.
Well,
so
yes.
Often it's drug users of many years' standing who are being convicted on capital charges here in Singapore. Right. And I think we could probably agree that if you've been using heroin for 50 years, you're not actually going to be doing rational thinking very well.
Well, let me come back to finish my point, which is that if there is that perception, people know that it's serious and people believe that it is more of a deterrent, then many more who would be drug traffickers will be deterred.
Someone who was one of those decades-long heroin users and convicted of trafficking drugs was Nasri bin Lajim. He was hanged in July 2022 at the age of 64.
Hi, Nazira. How are you?
Hi, I'm Linda.
Hello.
Nazira is still deeply upset by the death of her brother, Nasri, and she's one of few relatives of people executed by the Singapore state who continues to speak out. She tells us how her family grew up poor after her father died, leaving 10 kids. Nasri went off the rails.
My brother mixed the wrong company at the age of 14. He hooked to drugs. His life is that he's in out of prison for petty crime, that kind of thing. So there is a rehabilitation by the government, rehabilitation, but it doesn't work on him.
So he went in and out of rehabilitation?
In and out of this jail for three quarters of his life.
In 2017, Nasri was convicted of trafficking heroin. He was sentenced to hang. Appeals failed.
We tried to console him that, and he also consoled himself that it's his fate. His fate to leave this world by hanging. He accepted the fate. On my part, I cannot take it. Because I felt that you just give them a life sentence. That's the deterrent sentence for them.
Then Nasri was given notice that his execution would be carried out.
Before he died, we have to visit him every day. For the 1 week before he passed, he hanged.
And was he behind a glass?
Yeah, behind a panel of glass. We cannot touch him even. So the only thing I touch him when he there, or he become a corpse, then I can touch him and I kiss him when he already dead. That's the only time I can touch him. When he's already, my wife already dead. I kiss him when she's already dead. Otherwise, I cannot touch him for many, many years.
There's something else that Nazira can't let go of about her brother's conviction and execution. There was a co-accused in the case, but the other man wasn't sent to the gallows.
This supplier was given a life sentence. You tell me, where is the fairness? The police told us that this so-called supplier cooperated with the police. That's why he was given a life sentence. My brother told me that my brother also cooperated, but he was hanged. So why must I have this double standard?
What Nazira sees as a double standard is due to a clause in the law. It gives the court the option of sentencing someone to life imprisonment instead of death if two conditions are met. Firstly, if the judge rules the convicted person was only a drug courier. And secondly, if the public prosecutor issues what's called a certificate of substantive assistance. This means the defendant has given information to the authorities that's helped disrupt drug trafficking networks. For a judge to commute the death sentence, both these requirements must be present, says Jeremy Pereira, a criminal defence lawyer.
Even in cases where you are just a courier, but the prosecution does not give that certificate, the court still has to impose the death penalty. So, of course, I can understand why people would say this is arbitrary, because it kind of seems like the prosecutor also has a say in whether or not this person lives. Because if they do not issue that certificate, then the court has to impose the death penalty.
And in those cases, the judge has no jurisdiction over that. The judge has to give the death penalty. The judge is not involved in that decision of a certificate of substantive assistance.
Yes, that's correct. There have even been cases where I've dealt with where my client has provided names or numbers, but that did not lead to anything. You know, so if you provide numbers or names, but during their investigation, they find that, you know, this led to a dead end or they didn't get any positive outcome from it, they can still deny the certificate.
It sounds slightly lottery-like.
I think it's a dilemma some of my clients face, because you plead guilty to get a certificate, for instance, and tell you cooperating with the prosecution. But the risk also, which they are often fearful, is what if I cooperate and I don't get the certificate? Then essentially I've given all this information which may be used against me at the trial itself. Or it would make my case even worse if I'm fighting the case. So this is often a dilemma.
In cases where someone facing the death sentence is not given a certificate of substantive assistance, some defence lawyers would like to challenge that decision, to know why the information their client gave wasn't valuable. But that would mean laying out the evidence in court, a move the government believes would compromise intelligence and the mission to disrupt drug crime. And remember, someone may only be saved from the gallows if they have the certificate and the judge rules they were only the transporter of the narcotics. Luo Lingling, a defence lawyer, remembers acting for a man facing execution on a heroin trafficking charge. The judge ruled her client's role was not solely that of a drug courier.
Only after the judge announced that finding, then did the prosecutor say, oh, we are actually giving him the cert.
The Certificate of Substantive Assistance.
And when the prosecutor said that, I recall very vividly, I saw the judge look surprised. I always wonder in my heart, would she have arrived at a different decision and found that he's a courier? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know.
The point is, now the judge had only one option when it came to Luo Lingling's client. She had to sentence him to death.
I felt that was so unfair. I felt that it could have been a different outcome if the prosecution just stood up earlier and told everyone, oh, we are giving him the certificate. So I was in shock. And while I was digesting the information, I slowly packed my bags. And then I saw somebody limping across me. That was the client's mother. She started sobbing. She started running towards her son. She was limping. I saw her crying. I lost it. I also started crying. It was so bad. She reached into the small little gaps in between the glass panel, between her and her son. She couldn't hold her son, of course, because they were separated by the glass panel. It was so heartbreaking to see. It was really bad. It was so heartbreaking to see her trying to feel her son, touch her son for one last time. It was the worst day of my professional career. Yeah.
Luo Lingling says most of her clients on trafficking charges have a similar profile.
They were all funding habits. I don't think they would have done it if they were not addicted.
So these are not people who are running syndicates?
No, it's all the small fishers. They were from the low-income bracket.
She fights hard for her clients on death row, but that doesn't make her anti-capital punishment.
If you were to take away the death penalty for drug trafficking, it's going to be much worse. And I've got four kids. I don't want them to have easy access to drugs.
But even though you've described the difficulties as a defence lawyer...
It's ironic. It seems like a contradiction. But I'm thinking of the greater good, the small number of people who would suffer that penalty.
Singapore's lawyers don't speak with one voice on this.
Now, I'm personally not a fan of the death penalty. My personal view is that it is a harsh penalty because it's irreversible.
Jeremy Pereira remembers a case where the court believed a client who claimed that although he knew he was transporting a drug, he didn't know it was heroin and in a quantity that attracted the mandatory death penalty. The court believed this man.
He got 15 years. On appeal, the Court of Appeal reversed that decision and imposed the death penalty. And then what happened was a few years after that, another lawyer took up the matter again, reopened it before the Court of Appeal. And when the Court of Appeal looked at the case, they said, we think maybe something's not right here, let's reinstate the 15 years. And so my client went on a roller coaster, basically, from 15 years to death penalty and back to 15 years. But it does show that different courts looking at the matter can reach a different result.
And in July, a man who'd spent nearly 9 years on death row was, very unusually, released when the Court of Appeal ruled the prosecution had run an inconsistent case during his trial. I asked Kay Shanmugam, Singapore's Minister for Home Affairs and Law, what he makes of this.
If you look at what the court said, they suggested a retrial and the prosecution decided that they will not go for a retrial. He may actually have done it, but it has to be proven in court to the satisfaction of the court. The High Court agreed, the Court of Appeal disagreed. That's the rigour of the process.
But if the courts make mistakes, because they're basically we're human and we're fallible, that's the point about the death penalty, though. It has to be 100% right.
Yes, that's a fair point. I accept that. And it's one of the difficulties in public policy making, which is why you need to make it very rigorous. The argument that, it's possible that the courts may make a mistake and therefore you shouldn't have such a punishment, I don't buy that. I don't buy that because you have to focus on the individuals, but then you must never lose sight of the larger picture.
And for the minister, that's the potential that illicit substances have to harm society, impact families, and compromise the security of the state. Although the majority of Singaporeans back the use of the death penalty, one study recorded how only about a third of those asked supported its mandatory use in drug trafficking cases. But certainly, those actively campaigning against state executions are a tiny minority.
Mohammed Rizwan bin Akbar Hussein. Swaminathan Selvaraju.
In April 2022, at a protest in Hong Lim Park, the names of those then known to be on death row in Singapore were read aloud. Say their name was the refrain from the hundreds assembled.
It's the only park in Singapore where citizens can protest without having to get a police permit. My name is Kirsten Han, and I'm a member of the Transformative Justice Collective, and I've been working towards the abolition of the death penalty since 2010.
So you've been at this now for 14 years.
Yeah.
Do you think you're going to see the end of the death penalty in your lifetime here in Singapore?
It's really hard to predict because one thing that I've learned from activists, kind of both in Singapore and also elsewhere, a lot of them often say, like, it often feels like no change is going to happen at all. And then suddenly it comes at once. And I kind of hold on to that because I feel like right now we are worrying about execution notices, right? We've seen execution notices issued recently. Some of the prisoners have ongoing cases, but once those cases are concluded, will we just see this bloodbath stream like we did in 2022? That was really overwhelming because it would be like on the way to one funeral and then getting the news of a new execution notice for next week.
How many were executed in 2022?
I think 11 men were executed in about an 8-month period.
A further 8 people have been hanged for drug offences in 2023 and 2024, 2 of them for trafficking cannabis. The government won't tell the BBC how many people are presently on death row. Kirsten Han estimates there are around 50, all but a tiny handful for narcotics-related offences. And she, with other members of the Transformative Justice Collective, helped those facing imminent execution with their last-minute appeals.
It's always with consent of prisoner and family. We shouldn't be so shocked that death row prisoners want to file appeals. I think it is actually highly unnatural to expect someone to go, "Oh, I'm going to die. It's okay, I'll just sit here and wait nicely and quietly until the state comes and tells me when I will die." I think that is very strange. So it's not that we are putting them up to file appeals. We come across a lot of families and prisoners who don't want to file appeals and don't want public campaigns, and we leave them alone.
Recently, the Transformative Justice Collective was forced to cancel an exhibition on the history of the anti-death penalty movement. The authorities refused to issue the required licence because the show contained materials that undermine public trust and confidence in institutions involved in the administration of justice. And earlier this year, when Minister Shanmugam gave an overview of Singapore's drug policy to Parliament, he said activists have helped to file unmeritorious legal applications on behalf of convicted drug traffickers. As a result of the delays caused by these late appeals, there were prisoners awaiting capital punishment whose cases were decided more than a decade ago, he said. Kay Shanmugam named organisations and individuals, including Kirsten Han. I put it to him that, to me, given it was a widely reported parliamentary speech by a powerful minister, this looked like bullying.
I don't understand why you say this is bullying, because if you believe in free speech, then you shouldn't be in the shadows. The activists have a number of tactics, and I wanted to tell Singaporeans there are some of these tactics that are being used, and that's a matter for public discussion. So that part of my speech was to expose some of the things that they were doing. And what were they doing? The cases are over, the appeal is over, everything is over, but they give false hope to the victims and encourage them to make further and further applications. And it's entirely proper to talk about it in Parliament and say people are abusing this process.
But I don't think anyone's hiding that.
The perception that was being given in many cases is that these victims were doing it by themselves and the families. And I wanted to say there is a machinery behind it, there is a group behind it, there are people helping them, and there is an abuse of process going on.
Nobody can take one's life except for God. That's why I believe in that.
It's too late for Nazira's brother, hanged in 2022 after being convicted of trafficking heroin.
So you give him a life sentence, it's a death deterrent enough to punish them. So if you put life sentence, at least I can see my brother every now and then.
The minister's not for turning.
I've said in public policy, you need a kind heart, but a hard head. You need to be very clinical in assessing what the consequences of a policy are. And if you know that if you remove the death penalty, more people are going to die. But you do it for PR purposes and to be praised by the international media. Oh, you know, Singapore has removed the death penalty. While you know in your mind that more people, more Singaporeans and more people in general are going to die, that's a wrong policy.
But the finality of this punishment sits easily with you, does it?
Not at all. It sits very badly. Because taking away life is not something that any of us can be sanguine about. But our individual actions should be separated from our duty as policymakers acting for the benefit of the community as a whole.
Since I returned from Singapore, another man has been executed. Aswan Bin Bahari was hanged on Friday the 4th of October, having been convicted of trafficking 26.5 grams of heroin. That's all from Assignment in Singapore. I'm Linda Presley. The producer in Singapore was Rita Rahman. And this double edition of the documentary was expertly mixed in the studio by both James Beard and Neil Churchill. Penny Murphy is the editor.
What does Hezbollah want? Why is Kenya getting involved in Haiti?
What can the world's biggest iceberg tell us?
The Inquiry. One big question.
Can we trust Google?
Four expert witnesses.
Time for our second expert witness.
And an answer.
What will be the solution?
Explore the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world with The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.